We're in Judges chapter 19 this morning. We only got two more lessons left. Next week, Dustin will be preaching for Mother's Day, and then I will finish up with Judges after that. And then Steve's going to be teaching for a week to sort of take all of what we've learned in Judges. It's been a long study. And Steve is going to kind of wrap it up for us, not so much with a summary of it, but rather what do we do with it? Preaching through the Old Testament is difficult sometimes because it's sort of seeing Israel in the raw. We see they're good and they're bad, and quite oftentimes there's more bad than there is good. But it's all there for our benefit. So sometimes going through a book like Judges can be fairly weighty, but it's there for our benefit. And as we come to chapter 19 today, we're going to end up in probably the darkest part of the book. There's been some dark things that have kind of happened. But the author in these last five chapters has been sort of telling us what underlies the problem that Israel had. He talks about their spiritual and their moral corruption. Hey, Steve, does anybody want the lights on by chance? Yeah, somebody know where the lights are, maybe flip the lights on. We put them down for the singing, but I was looking back there and all I see is some dark shadows. So, and maybe the back. You can bring them both on. I'm just saying, it's rather just the front, turn the front and the back on. But as we've been looking at the moral and spiritual corruption with Israel, it kind of takes us into this very dark section of the book that kind of is a little bit weighty, a little bit hard to sometimes go through. And it leaves us with, you know, when you leave here this morning, you may find yourself kind of saying, man, that was dark. And we do our best to try to find out what we can do with it ourselves. But one of the things we're going to do is Steve's going to try to tackle this for us in a couple of weeks, where he's going to sort of put a cap on all this for us and talk to us from kind of a New Testament perspective. What do we do with this stuff? So today we're in a very, like I said, a very dark section of the book. We'll work our way through it. There's some sensitive stuff in here. I'll be sensitive with the children in the audience today. And we'll leave some of the text for you to explain more deeply to your children. But I think you'll understand as we kind of go through it. As I mentioned, there's two sections to this last part of the book. Spiritual corruption is what we dealt with the last 2 weeks, where we saw the spiritual corruption that had taken place in Israel. The last three chapters now deal with the moral corruption. And it's basically what follows spiritual corruption. When you look at a society in general or a people in general, when you see their moral corruption, it's because they're corrupted spiritually. The two go hand in hand. And so it's no wonder why the author started with the spiritual corruption first and now takes us into the end result of that, the moral corruption. We're going to break this last bit down into two parts. We're going to see part one today, and it's a setup for what's going to happen in 2 weeks. Okay? But we're starting in chapter 19 of Judges. I'm going to break this into two parts. The hospitality of the Levite's father-in-law, and then the horror of what happens in Gibeah. Okay? Let's look at the first part of this. The first verses 1 through 10 is what we're going to start with. Now it came about in those days when there was no king in Israel that there was a certain Levite staying in the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim who took a concubine for himself from Bethlehem in Judea, or in Judah. But his concubine played the harlot against him, and she went away from him to her father's house in Bethlehem in Judah, and she was there for a period of 4 months. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak tenderly to her in order to bring her back, taking with him his servant and a pair of donkeys. So he brought him into her father's house, and when the girl's father saw him, he was glad to meet him. So what we basically have is this Levite who's living in the hill country of Ephraim, and it says that he's got a concubine. Now a concubine is basically like a wife, but usually a second-class wife. Generally, if you think of the structure that we have in the Middle East, a man would have multiple wives oftentimes. It's not something condoned by the scriptures. It was something that they did in their culture and society. And so the first woman would generally be a wife. And her primary responsibility was to bear children and raise a family. But then oftentimes they would take something called a concubine, or more than one. And that was like a secondary wife. And it was for pleasure, let's just say it that way. And so the fact that this Levite here has a concubine implies that he probably also had a wife. Now, they were treated legally as wives, but again, they were sort of a second-class wife, if you will. And so immediately out of the gate, we see a problem with this Levite. He's engaging in activity that was ultimately forbidden by the law, but he has this concubine. And this concubine, it says, actually went off and played the harlot, which meant that she went off and participated with other men. And so after that, whether it was through embarrassment or shame or anything else, we don't know or just the fact that she didn't like this Levite priest anymore, she takes off and she goes back to her father's house. And she's there for 4 months. And so this Levite decides that he misses this concubine. So he decides to pack his bags up with his servant and a couple of donkeys, and he brings some gifts. And he goes back to his father-in-law's house to win his concubine back. And it says that he spoke tenderly to her. So he's obviously got some affections for her. He wants to win her back or bring her back to Ephraim, the hill country there. When the father-in-law meets him, it says that he rejoiced. He was glad to meet him. So the father-in-law is happy that he's there. But look at what else kind of happens. And this is where the setup sort of starts. We're going to see this father-in-law extend an amazing amount of hospitality to this Levite. It says in verse 3, then her husband arose and went after, or I'm sorry, verse 4. His father-in-law, the girl's father, detained him, and he remained with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and lodged there. A better rendering of that would be that he persuaded him to stay. So he didn't physically detain him, he just persuaded him to stay. He persuaded him to stay for 3 days. Now on the fourth day, after they got up early in the morning, and he prepared to go, the girl's father said to his son-in-law, sustain yourself with a piece of bread, and afterwards you may go. So now he offers him breakfast, basically. Stick around, I'll let you go after you're done eating breakfast. So both men, verse 6, sat down and ate and drank together. And the girl's father said to the man, please be willing to spend the night and let your heart be merry. So now after breakfast, he had promised him, well, just stay around for breakfast, I'll let you go after that. But then as they finished breakfast, he said, won't you stick around for a little bit longer? Just stay the night and then you can go tomorrow. Verse 7, then the man arose to go, but his father-in-law urged him so that he spent the night there again. On the fifth day, he arose to go early in the morning, and the girl's father said, please sustain yourself and wait until the afternoon. So both of them ate. When the man arose to go along with his concubine and servant, his father-in-law, the girl's father, said to him, behold now, the day is drawn to a close. Please spend the night. Lo, the day is coming to an end. Spend the night here, that your heart may be merry. Then tomorrow you may arise early for your journey, so that you may go home. So what we basically have is it's a bit of a setup here. We have this father-in-law, who it says rejoiced, was thrilled, happy when his son-in-law came to pick up his daughter. And so he offers what was typical in ancient Near East, which was hospitality, and the rule was sort of you stick around for 3 days. You had to offer your visitors an opportunity to stay for 3 days, provide them with lodging and food and all that kind of stuff. And so he does that. But as that time ends and the man gets up to leave, the father-in-law says, well, why don't you stick around for brunch here? We'll feed you, and then you can go a little bit later today. So when he does that, after the meal is done, he says, well, just hang around a little bit longer. So now it's late enough in the evening that he has to stay because it's dark out. And he does this a couple of different times. And so the point of the author appears to be here to set the story up by showing us this amazing hospitality of this father-in-law. Because something's coming later in the story that's going to be quite the opposite of that. And so this passage almost becomes somewhat comical. Can you imagine what this must have been? This Levite, he's anxious to get on his way, and his father-in-law is begging him to stay. And so he finally, you know, relents and says, okay, I'll stick around for breakfast. But then as breakfast kind of finishes, the father-in-law is putting the thumb screws to you again. Well, come on, you know, it reminds you of some of those sitcoms and stuff where they have the mother-in-law trying to feed their, you know, their in-laws. And they just, you know, we watch Gomer Pyle. We love Gomer Pyle. And there was one episode where, actually a couple of episodes where there's a woman trying to feed Gomer. And he's like, he can't eat anymore. But she's just like, you have to eat more. And so he eats more. And then, you know, you have to. And he's just, the guy's busting at the gut. You know, you have to. You don't love me if you don't eat more. That's kind of the picture that you get with this father-in-law. Is he's going out of his way well above and beyond the expected hospitality in the Middle East. And that's ultimately what you see here. Now, we find that the Levite here in verse 10 decides that it's too much and he has to leave. And so it says in verse 10, but the man was not willing to spend the night, so he arose and departed and came to a place opposite Jebus, which is Jerusalem. And there with him a pair of saddled donkeys, his concubine also was with him. And so ultimately the man finally leaves after 5 days of hospitality. You know, what's interesting is the Old Testament, and this is why I think this is so important, the Old Testament actually has a fair amount to say about hospitality. It was something that was expected. It wasn't just part of the culture, but it was something God expected in the Old Testament. Exodus chapter 22, verse 21 says, you shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Notice the emphasis there, hospitality to strangers. Israel was expected to offer hospitality to those strangers, partly because they were strangers at one time themselves. Exodus chapter 23, verse 9 says this, "You shall not oppress a stranger, since you yourselves know the feelings of a stranger, for you yourselves were strangers in the land of Egypt." It's also commanded in the New Testament. Turn a couple of passages with me. Romans chapter 12. And again, this is all set up here, folks, for what's about to happen. But Romans chapter 12, look at verses 10 through 14. Paul says to his readers, "Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Give preference to one another in honor. Not lagging behind in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, persevering in tribulation, devoted to prayer, contributing to the needs of the saints, practicing hospitality." Turn to Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews chapter 13, the first three verses there. He says, "Let love of the brethren continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by this some have entertained angels without knowing it. Remember the prisoners as though in prison with them, and those who are ill-treated, since you yourselves also are in the body." In other words, be hospitable to one another. You know, one of the traits for elders in the New Testament is that they have to be hospitable. It's a requirement, which means we all get to go to the Schmackles for lunch today, right? Timothy, also when Paul is talking to Timothy, and he's talking about widows that are to be put on a list. In other words, as they're looking at how to take care of orphans and widows in the church, one of the requirements for those widows to be put on the list to be cared for by the church was that they had to have practiced hospitality. Paul actually mentions that to Timothy in chapter 5, that if this widow has practiced hospitality, then consider her to be taken care of by the church. And so hospitality is a theme, if you will, that runs from the Old Testament all the way into the New Testament. The Bible's filled. You think about Abraham and the strangers that Abraham attended to on more than one instance. You got David's army at different times being provided with bedding, and as he comes to place, he's been provided for. His men are given food and taken care of. You've got the poor widow that cared for Elijah out of her own poverty, took care of Elijah, and was blessed as a result of that. And so you get this theme of hospitality that's incredibly important in the Old and the New Testament, not only commanded but expected. And I think there's probably a key for that, or a key to understanding that. Hospitality is important to God, not just because God has been hospitable to us, but because it actually indicates what's going on in here. Hospitality demonstrates a moral conviction. I think about my parents in this. One of the reasons my parents were so well-liked, I think, is because of that very thing. My parents have always been extremely hospitable. Not just to, you know, as we were growing up, our place was the place to be. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. We had a number of stay-at-home moms in the neighborhood, but all the kids were always welcome and always came down to our house and played in our yard and played with us kids. My mom and dad always had their doors open. When we would have our get-togethers with my dad's brothers and sisters, my dad had 8 brothers and sisters. Many of them still lived up in Green Bay. We would have these get-togethers on the weekend, cookouts and all that. And it was always kind of my dad and mom that would plan that stuff. When Christmas came, everybody was at our house. We'd have 50, 60 people crammed in a 1,300-square-foot ranch-style house for Christmas every year because our place was always the place to be. And you would see that with my mom and dad. They were extremely hospitable. There wasn't anything you could ask that they wouldn't do. And what that actually represents is what goes on here. When you're hospitable to other people, it says a lot about your moral character. What you think of other people, how you treat other people. One of the things I learned from my dad, and it's something that I find myself doing not so much because it's my nature, but more out of habit, is my dad, when he would be at a checkout at some place, whenever things would finish up, he would say, "Well, thank you very much," or he'd say something specifically to encourage the cashier or to a restaurant when he's leaving. And I find myself doing that sometimes when I'm checking out of a Menards or out of a Home Depot or I'm paying a bill. Oftentimes I find myself looking at the name tag of the person and trying to say, "Thank you, so-and-so. I appreciate what you've done today." And it was my dad's way of trying to help other people feel good, if you will. And so it all kind of boils down. Hospitality is important to God, not just because he's hospitable, but it says something about our moral character, what we value, and how we treat other people. And so that's the contrast that's actually set up in this passage, because something now happens that is the direct opposite of this Levite's father-in-law. And so the author goes through this detail of kind of building up this Levite's father-in-law and showing his hospitality is way above and beyond and so over the top because he wants us to see the depravity and the horror that takes place now of those who are quite the opposite of the hospitable servant. Let's look at verses 11 through 30. When they were near Jebus, now the Levite and the concubine and the servant are traveling. They're trying to go back to Ephraim. When they were near Jebus, which was basically Jerusalem, it was still occupied by the Canaanites at this time, the day was almost gone, and the servant said to his master, "Please come and let us turn aside into the city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it." However, the master said to him, "We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who are not the sons of Israel, but we will go as far as Gibeah." And so basically what happens here is the servant says, "Hey, it's getting dark, it's getting dangerous. We need to stop for the night." And so here's a great place to stop. It's Jerusalem. And the Levite says, "Well, we can't stop here because these people are foreigners. They were Canaanites. We certainly couldn't expect hospitality from them. In fact, it might have been a little bit dangerous from his perspective." So instead, he says, "We can't stay here. We're going to have to move on." Verse 12, "However, his master said to him, 'We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners because they are not of Israel, but we will go as far as Gibeah.'" Now, Gibeah was an Israelite city in the land of Benjamin. So what he's basically said is, "We can't stay here. These people are foreigners. They won't put us down for the night. They might not be friendly. They might even be dangerous. So we need to go to our brothers and sisters in Gibeah, fellow Israelites, because certainly they'll be hospitable to us." Verse 13, he said to his servant, "Come now, and let us approach one of these places, and we will spend the night in Gibeah or Ramah." So they passed along and went their way, and the sun set on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin, or is in the place of Benjamin. They turned aside there in order to enter and lodge in Gibeah. When they entered, they sat down in the open square of the city, but no one took them into his house to spend the night. So what's the first thing we see here? Again, a little bit of a contrast. He decides to go to Gibeah where he expects the hospitality to be extended to him because these are brothers and sisters in Israel. But they end up getting into the city center and absolutely nobody offers him any lodging of any kind. So that's our first indication that something's not right here because, again, it comes up against this contrast of the Levite's father-in-law who is overly hospitable and they can't find any hospitality in the city that they're in. But then look what happens. It says in verse 16, "Then behold, an old man was coming out of the field from his work at evening. Now the man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was staying in Gibeah. But the men of the place were Benjamites." There's another little clue there that the author is giving us. He tells us, well, this particular man isn't even from this area. He's from Ephraim, the same place that the Levite is from. And he goes to great lengths to tell us he's not a Benjamite. So he's not from this place, he's only staying here. He's going to be the only one that offers him hospitality. Again, there's a contrast there. That nobody, none of the Israelites in this city, were willing to offer this guy a place to stay. But it gets worse. "And he lifted up his eyes, and he saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, 'Where are you going, and where do you come from?'" Verse 18, "He said to him, 'We are passing from Bethlehem in Judah to the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim, for I am from there, and I went to Bethlehem in Judah. But I'm now going to my house, and no man will take me into his house. Yet there is both straw and fodder for our donkeys, and also bread and wine for me, your maidservant, and the young man who is with your servants, there is no lack of anything." Catch what he said there? He's like, nobody will take me in, even though it will not be a burden to them, because I have everything that I need, not just for my needs, but even the needs of my animals. So what we find here is that this man would not even be a burden to anybody. All they had to give him was a place to lay down. They will not be out anything. He brought everything he needed, his food, his water, even enough stuff for his donkey. Now, one of the things we learn about hospitality is that generally hospitality costs you something, doesn't it? You have somebody in your house, you provide them with something, you offer them a drink, you give them some food, right? You offer them something. Usually, hospitality costs you something, just like God's hospitality to us cost him something, did it not? And yet in this particular instance, these people in the city can't even be hospitable when it's not going to cost them anything. Everything that this man needs is taken care of by his own hand. And so the author gives us another clue as to the depth of the problem here. So this old man basically offers them a place to stay. Now this old man actually feeds them and whatnot. He says in verse 20, "Peace to you, only let me take care of all your needs." You see, that's hospitality. He's doing what he should do. "Do not spend the night in this open square." Probably a warning there about the danger. He understood this city, and they're going to see that in just a minute here. It was not a safe place to be. Verse 21, "So he took him into his house, and he gave the donkeys fodder, and they washed their feet, and they ate and drank." So again, we see this man, who's not from this area, offer hospitality. So the author has set the stage for us now with the Levite's father-in-law, going over the top in hospitality. This city now that isn't offering him anything in violation of the law even. And again, the contrast between the old man who now does offer hospitality to them. Now what happens next is rather shocking. And it basically describes to us the utter and complete moral depravity of the men in the city of Gibeah. Look at verse 22. "While they were celebrating, behold, the men of the city, certain worthless fellows, surrounded the house, pounding the door, and they spoke to the owner of the house." I believe that's a little irony of the author's part there. They spoke. They were probably yelling and screaming. They're hammering on the door. But the author says, oh, they spoke. A little bit of irony. "They spoke to the owner of the house, the old man, saying, 'Bring out the man who came into your house, that we may have relations with him.'" That's wrong on multiple fronts, right, folks? Not only the whole homosexual thing, but the fact that they're wanting to, in essence, abuse this man. Now, what's interesting about this is there's a parallel between this and what happens in Sodom and Gomorrah. You remember that story? The details are incredibly similar, and there's a reason for that. But what's interesting here is that these men here only ask for the Levite priest. I think there's a message there. There was a concubine. There was another young servant there. There was the man's virgin daughter. We're going to find out here in a minute. But all these men were interested in was defiling a Levite priest. I think there's I think it's the author's way of indicating their depravity. I mean, there's even a religious link to this now. They weren't just interested in relations with another man. It was specifically with a priest that they could defile. Again, the utter depravity of these men. But then, look what happens. So these men come and they knock on the door. They ask for the priest to come out. It says, verse 23, "Then the man, the owner of the house, went out to them and said to them, 'No, my fellows, please do not act so wickedly, since this man has come into my house. Do not commit this act of folly.' Then he says, 'Here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. Please let me bring them out to you, and you may ravish them and do to them whatever you wish. But do not commit such an act of folly against this man.'" Now what's interesting about that is anybody that's got any conscience at all knows how wicked that is. So now we even see this supposedly hospitable man do an ungodly act or think ungodly. In trying to protect this Levite priest, he basically offers up his daughter and the man's concubine. And obviously the men of the city are not interested in that. Verse 25, "But the men would not listen to him, so the man," now it's the Levite here, "the man," the Levite, "seized his concubine and brought her to them, and they basically abuse her all night long until morning. And basically the Levite goes back in and goes to sleep." How wicked is that? Remember, this is an Israelite city, knew the law, knew God, and yet you have these men doing wicked, wicked things. Not just the men of the city who demand this behavior, but now even this old man and this Levite priest do the unthinkable. They give in to these men and their demands. In fact, the Levite actually sacrifices his concubine for his own protection and his own safety. Now, how many of us here as men could think that such a thing is even remotely right? Can you see the moral depravity that's taking place here? That this stuff is taking place in a city that's owned by God, if you will. It's supposed to know Him. But it gets even worse. Verse 26, as the day began to dawn, meaning morning had come, the woman came and fell down at the doorway of the man's house where her master was there until full daylight. When the master, the Levite, rose in the morning and opened the door of the house and went to go on his way. Did you catch that? No concern. This is the man who just traveled who knows how far, probably a couple hundred miles, to get his concubine because he was missing her. And now is so easily able to basically toss her out to protect his own life. And then goes to bed. No concern. The next morning simply gets up to leave. There's no mention that he was even concerned about her. But he simply gets up to leave. And as he opens the door, it says here that his concubine was laying at the doorway of the house with her hand on the threshold. She had made it all the way back to the door, but had died there. Imagine that. It's a very graphic description. As he opens the door, likely she kind of fell into the floor there at his feet. Now look at what he does. Verse 28. He said to her, "Get up, let's go." But there was no answer. So he basically picks her up, throws her on his donkey, and they head home. How callous is that? Can you see now why the author started off with this hospitality of the Levite's father-in-law? He's trying to set up this contrast. He's basically showing this father-in-law, living out the law, being gracious, and going way above and beyond what the law even asks for in terms of hospitality. And he wants to set that up to basically show the depths of the depravity of everything else in this chapter. The wickedness of Gibeah that should have offered sanctuary, a gracious place to stay. And even the old man who was willing to offer the hospitality is corrupt in his own in our eyes here as well, because he's willing to toss out his virgin daughter and the man's concubine. And then we see the callousness of this Levite priest. And to make matters worse, look at what the Levite priest does in verses 29 and 30. And this sets up the stage for what happens 2 weeks from now. When he entered his house, he took a knife and he laid hold of his concubine, who's now dead at this point. And he cut her into 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout the territory of Israel. And all who saw it, nothing like this has ever happened or been seen from this day when the sons of Israel came up from the land of Egypt to this day. Consider it and take counsel and speak up. Basically what he does here is he's so enraged by what happened to his concubine, supposedly, by the actions of these Gibeah men, that he goes home and he takes and he cuts her up. Now, a Levite's not supposed to touch a dead body, so he shouldn't have thrown his concubine on his donkey the way he did. But now to go and to dice her up into pieces and desecrate a body without giving it even a second thought, and then sending those pieces to the 12 tribes of Israel, is just a wicked thing. And he does it to enrage them and to call them to his side. And what we're going to see in the next two chapters, and we'll cover this in 1 week, 2 weeks from now, it enrages the Israelites. And they're all inflamed because of what had happened to his concubine. But what's rather interesting about these men is when you get to the end of the story, they're doing the same exact thing that the men of Gibeah did to the concubine. And they can't see it. They're too morally corrupt. And so what we basically find in this is a very dark chapter. And the question is, what do we actually do with it? I think there's two primary purposes of it. One is that it's going to set the stage for what happens next. It's just basically, we need to know why they do what they do next, which is basically the civil war that takes place, and they almost lose one of the tribes of Israel because of this and because of some other behavior. But it also presents a picture of the utter and moral corruption that existed in Israel. And you have to ask the question, how in the world did Israel get to this point? You know, God in his calling of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all the amazing things that God has done. And then you know, their time in Egypt and then God rescuing from Egypt and all the miracles and the wonders that God did to bring them out of Egypt and crossing through the desert and providing for their needs there. And then bringing them into Jericho and watching the amazing things that God did as he marched out these Canaanite armies that were much more military than Israel and bigger and stronger. And yet God annihilated them and Israel comes into the land and takes possession of it. And then you look at what happens with the story of Judges, where he constantly delivers Israel over and over and over, and you got to ask yourself the question, how in the stink does Israel ignore all that and get to the place where they're willing to not only tolerate, but engage in this kind of activity? So the author uses this theme of hospitality here to sort of, I think, just simply, it's a secondary thing. You know, if I were to preach this passage and say the goal, the takeaway for us here is that we all have to be hospitable, we've missed the point. That's just the tool that the author uses, because it would have been something the Israelites would have understood. This wickedness, the hospitality problem was really about moral corruption. It was what was in their hearts. So what do we actually do with this? I think we can make a parallel here for ourselves, and it's what we've already seen, that there is a direct link between our spiritual condition and our moral condition. If you want to know why people struggle morally, it's because they struggle spiritually, and that is true of the unsaved as well as the saved. What you think, your theology, your place in Christ, your relationship to Him, directly affects how you behave. My daughters, especially Kimberly over the years, you know, it was asked about why we sin, you know. And the reality, my answer is always because we want to. It's what's in our heart oftentimes, you know. And so if you want to figure out why we behave the way we do or why the world behaves the way it does, just look at their spiritual condition, which means that there's a life lesson there for us. When we are not in the proper relationship with Christ, it affects us morally. And I'm not talking about just salvation. Because just because you're saved doesn't necessarily mean you're growing in Christ. Just because you're saved does not mean that the daily relationship with Christ is as deep as it needs to be, right? I've shared this a number of times. Dr. Earl Rodmacher, the first hermeneutics course I had in terms of how to interpret the scriptures came from Earl Rodmacher, the president of Western Seminary. And he used to say repeatedly, don't get saved and stuck. Meaning, get your fire insurance, and then from there on out, it's just live as you always have. We went through the book of Ephesians not too long ago, which taught us about the need to live in a manner worthy of our calling. In other words, once we get saved, the hard work begins. And the hard work is learning to live in obedience to Christ. And as we grow in that relationship with Christ, it affects our behavior. And so the lesson that we can take away from this passage, I think, is that the reason Israel was in the place they were was because of their spiritual condition. And if we don't pay attention to our spiritual condition, then we will suffer in terms of our behavior. Why is it we can look sometimes and we can see these Christians do horrible, horrific things? I'm not going to name names, but we've seen that. You know, occasionally on the news and whatnot, you see these stories of these Christian leaders that fall and stumble, and you wonder, how can they get to that place? It's simply an indicator of where they were at spiritually. Plain and simple. And I think we all struggle with it to some degree. Think about the last time you did something that you were ashamed of as a believer. You know, maybe you said something, maybe you did something, maybe you responded in a way you shouldn't have. And ask yourself the question, how really at that particular moment, what was driving that behavior? Was it my relationship with Christ or my flesh? So if we want to avoid what happened to Israel here, then we need to focus and pay attention on our spiritual condition. And again, not our salvation, but rather where are we at currently with Christ? What kind of time do we give Him? How much time do we spend learning about Him? How much time do we spend committed to Him? I've been studying through the book of Philippians because that's going to be the next series we go through. And it's been a refreshing, it's been a breath of fresh air, especially coming off of an Old Testament passage. And I can't wait until we can get into it. But I'm going to just highlight one thing because I think it summarizes a principle for us here, and I'll close with this. But just turn to Philippians chapter 1 with me. Paul prays something for the Philippians, and it gets right to the heart of what we're talking about here this morning. When we go through the book of Philippians, it's going to be from I don't usually title the series we go through. It's just, you know, Judges is called Judges. How creative is that, right? But, you know, if you go to any big mega church or most churches nowadays, they always have these big series, and they do all the wonderful graphics and stuff, you know. Well, we're going to do that with Philippians. It's going to be gospel-centered. And it's because almost everything Paul does in the book of Philippians is about gospel-centeredness. And the first thing he talks about is his relationship with the Philippians and how it's gospel-centered. But when he's praying for them, he says this in verse 9 of chapter 1. And this I pray, that your love may abound still more and more in real knowledge and discernment. And what he's getting at there is when you parse that out, when you break it apart to figure out exactly what Paul is saying, he's talking there about their relationship with Christ and how he wants them in their experience to grow in better knowledge and discernment of God's things. In other words, he's saying, I pray that you may grow in that relationship with Christ, that you, and it might be expressed through your love. So in other words, he wants them to be able to look at them and go, wow, they are growing in their relationship with Christ and getting more mature, and it's expressed through their love. But then he tells us why that's so important. He says in verse 10, so that you may approve the things that are excellent, in order to be sincere and blameless until the day of Christ. The whole point there of Paul is he's praying for them that their relationship with Christ might grow so that their behavior can be proven to be excellent. In other words, the key for them to stand blameless before Christ, not so much in a salvation standpoint because their sins are washed away, but to be able to stand before Christ blameless in their day-to-day lives requires that they grow, that they abound more and more in the knowledge and discernment of Jesus Christ. And so Paul, as he's praying for the Philippians, understands the key. How is it that the Israelites could have avoided where they were at? Plain and simple, they could have given more attention to following the laws of God. They could have paid attention to the relationship with Him. But because they allowed that to disintegrate into paganism, they began to do in Gibeah and the rest of Israel exactly what they had done in Sodom and Gomorrah and the rest of Canaan. What the author has basically done in the book of Judges here is said, look, Gibeah was the Sodom and Gomorrah within Israel, all because they had abandoned the right relationship with their Heavenly Father. We're not immune from that. I can tell you in my own life, it is hard sometimes doing the right thing when I really honestly don't feel all that close to Christ for whatever reason. You know, and you can tell when my focus isn't where it needs to be or that relationship with God is struggling a little bit. You can see it in my behavior. And that, I think, is a takeaway for us from this. Now, like I said, it's kind of a difficult and a dark passage. I hate to close out a series on that. We're going to see some similar things in the next week we do this, which is why Steve's going to follow up with sort of a, what do we do with this? But again, food for thought. How did Israel get there? The same way we would. If we don't pay enough attention to the relationship with Christ, Paul actually tells the Philippians here, work out your own salvation at one point. What he's getting at there, not is there salvation in Christ, but rather sanctification. It means you have to work at it. You have to work at that relationship with Christ. Just like you do a relationship with your kids, relationship with your wife. And just like when that relationship with your wife is tight, you treat her better. When your relationship with your kids is right, you treat them better. The same thing happens with God. When our relationship with right was with Him, our behavior reflects that. Amen?